Welcome to Episcopals, bringing you the latest in faith-based advocacy from the Episcopal Church Office of Government Relations.
So again, welcome. My name is Alan Yarborough. I'm excited to be joined by our two guests, two colleagues, actually. Really wonderful to work with these two folks. Daniel, I was going to start with you. I was wondering if you could introduce yourself. Tell us a bit about who you are and what you do for Global Partnerships.
Thank you so much, Alan. My name is Daniel Karanja, and I serve as the Partnership Officer for the Episcopal Church for Africa. And in my work, I'm primarily working with all the provinces, Anglican provinces, in Africa, about 12 of them. These are 12 large areas that primarily focus on Anglicans or Episcopalians, to use the term that we use here in the US. And my job is to inspire and build and nurture relationships across the church, ecumenical relations, and interfaith contacts that I come into contact with. This work offers opportunity for prayer, for companionship, for advocacy work, to seek resources that could also help the growth of the church and inspire faith and discipleship here within the Episcopal Church. And the extent of the work goes from Burundi to Central Africa, Mozambique, Angola, Congo, Sudan, South Sudan, Kenya, and Tanzania, among others. Most of my primary contacts are primates, like bishops, parish leaders, and a very important constituency in this work, theological educators and leadership trainers, those who are involved with preparing the next generation of leaders within the church in Africa.
Thank you, Daniel. That's really helpful. And just want to note as well, appreciate the work that you do and the whole Global Partnerships team, in part because of the fruit that bears through the Young Adult Service Corps. I was lucky enough to serve as a missionary for the church through that program. I was placed in Haiti, so not on the continent of Africa. But still a product of relationship building and that work that you just reviewed around the world through the Anglican Communion. So it really is a wonderful opportunity that builds connection, you know, here in the U.S. And with others across the world. And then since I served in Haiti, I've been working at the Office of Government Relations with Patricia Kasari, who is, I'll introduce herself and share a little bit about her portfolio with us.
Thanks, Alan, and hello, everyone. Thanks for joining us today. So my name is Patricia Kasari. I serve as the International Policy Advisor on advocacy for the Episcopal Church, but also for the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, our full communion partner here in the U.S. In terms of areas of focus for me, as you can imagine, having an international portfolio is very vast, but we do have some priorities that we work on a yearly basis. So this year, you know, my focus really is to advocate for robust foreign assistance, meaning funding from the US government to support international programs that both look to serve people who are experiencing humanitarian crises, but also to support countries in their economic development initiatives. Other areas that I focus on really quickly are gender justice, particularly on preventing gender-based violence. Our focus is usually women and girls, and focusing mostly on how we do programs and how we address gender-based violence as a country when we are operating in those in different ways, whether it's humanitarian spaces or when we're supporting development activities. The other key piece that I want to make sure to mention is the work that we do around peace building and conflict prevention with our partners overseas. The US government, although spends a lot of money on military assistance, has some programs that are not as huge, but they're there around peace building and conflict prevention around the world. So that's in a nutshell is what I do with the Office of Government Relations.
Great. Thanks, Patricia. And it's just wonderful to be in conversation with you both today. So I have some questions for both of you. Some apply more to one of you than the other, but I hope that it can facilitate an opportunity for us to learn together and to see where Episcopalians can plug into this work. And so the first one, Patricia, though, may be at least initially more directed towards you. What was the Africa Summit that the Biden administration held, and why do you think the Biden administration decided to host that summit 2 years into President Biden's term?
Yeah, so the Africa Summit was a summit that President Biden held in the fall last year, invited leaders from African countries who came to DC to have consultations and discussions around different issues that affect African countries as a bloc. It was only the second time that the US has held that such a summit. The first one was held by President Obama years ago. So it was celebrated by many people, including myself, because one, it was an indication of the desire to re-engage with the continent. But it was also a reminder that we need to do more because it's only the second time that kind of summit has been held. I mean, there's so many assumptions as in terms of what could have been the driver of such a summit. But I think one thing I like to highlight and maybe might be the reason that went into the calculation to the US government why such a summit would be important is when you look at what's happening in the world right now, Africa is the fastest growing continent. And the continent is also the most youthful continent. So they have the largest population of young people. And then they have this growing middle class. And all these three aspects really present an opportunity for engagement to the US government that I think has not been something that they have paid attention to as much in the past. So it presents an opportunity for expansion of US engagement in Africa beyond what's already being done at the moment.
Yeah, and I mean, Africa is such a large and diverse place. And I think both just on its own, but then also with interesting and parallel dynamics within the Anglican community in itself. Daniel, I don't know if you have anything to sort of add to what Patricia shared or reflect on to what Patricia just shared about the summit and new attention on the continent of Africa.
Sure. So traveling on the continent, which I've done quite a bit, you can see the footprint of China all over the place, whether it's the highways, the significant construction projects that are going on. So I would say that geopolitical realities with China in Africa, that the US cannot afford to be on the sidelines. I would say probably this whole engagement and disengagement kind of create some ambivalence among the African leaders, because one administration will come and have a different policy for Africa or no policy for Africa. Then another administration will focus on US national security interests that have nothing to do with the local populations. So I would say that probably the summit was an opportunity to reaffirm shared interests And hopefully go beyond that. It was encouraging to see the president's wife visit Africa shortly after the summit, and being able to go not to the cities, but go to the villages and meet with women and learn and hear directly from those who are vulnerable to human suffering. So I think the summit was timely, but in order for that chain of trust to be unbroken, it will have to be sustained beyond just, you know, a mere 1 week summit or a drop in here and there by the Secretary of State on the so-called hotspots. But the reality that China and Russia, now Russia, that they have, you know, significant footprints in Africa, and the U.S. cannot afford to be on the sidelines.
Well, and, you know, knowing that there are dozens of countries and even more dynamics, you know, going on across Africa. And you mentioned several in your introduction, Daniel, but I'm wondering sort of what from the African perspective, such as it is, I know that's a very big topic. What are some of the challenges facing the continent overall right now, and particularly where the U.S. may or may not be involved?
So I would start with vulnerability to natural disasters. I mean, we are right now witnessing the destructive forces of Cyclone Freddy that hit Mozambique twice before moving up north into Malawi. And the devastation that the morning of, I was on the phone with the Bishop of Zambezia in Mozambique, Vicente Msosa. And this morning we received a note from the Archbishop of Mozambique and Angora asking for, you know, humanitarian assistance. So I would say that some of the challenges that are facing Africa, it is so vulnerable to even disasters that could be prevented. Well, given the tie-in with climate change and all the challenges, I think it's important for the U.S. to remember, and the Episcopalians specifically to remember, that whatever partnerships they have, they are very important to sustain because they pay huge dividends in times of crisis and in times of disaster. Food security is also another area of concern. Before this call, I was on the phone with a dentist from Nairobi in Kenya who was sharing with me about the devastation that Kenya has suffered as a result of many, many, many months of drought. And not just Kenya, actually, a good part of the continent has suffered food insecurity as a result of rain-fed agriculture. And this is an area that is highly preventable. If there are projects that could focus on non-rain-fed agriculture, then communities can have self-sustainable resources to fend for themselves. And the last one I would say is the vulnerability during transitions of political power, where we have we see the most, you know, the worst of humanity come out in ethnic violence that is witnessed in many, many, many places. Again, this is an area that we know the calendar, we know the cycle. Why should we wait until it comes around again? Well, there's so much that can be done in between. But it's unfortunate that it only makes the news cycle when bad stuff has happened, but not when we have opportunities to do good and do it well.
And I want to come back to that, the doing good and doing it well. But Patricia, I'm wondering if you have anything to add or even just affirm in terms of the challenges facing the continent.
Right. Yeah, I think the climate crisis is a big one for the continent. You know, Daniel mentioned famine experience in the Horn of Africa right now, for example, is a big challenge. So the U.S. government has programs such as what they call PREPARE to support some climate adaptation initiatives in Africa, but it's a much smaller program that was needed. So that's one thing I wanted to highlight. The other challenge, maybe if I would like to add, is youth unemployment. And this is not talked about often in the policy circles, but it's really, really critical. The average age of young people in Africa, like, you know, in terms of population, is 19. And the African Union defines youth, anybody from 15 to 35 belongs to that kind of age group. And so when you look at the way people are working or unemployment as such, you find that one in third youth people in Africa are not employed. And then another third of it, of the population, is actually vulnerably employed, meaning they are working in an environment where their jobs are not secure. So if you think about sustainable development goals, these lofty goals out of the United Nations that all countries discussed and agreed upon, there's no way we can meet sustainable development goals in Africa if we're not addressing the issue of youth unemployment. So that is really critical to really insert in the conversations here in DC, but also, you know, in spaces like the United Nations, at the African Union in Addis Ababa, where all African countries meet and discuss African solutions. And another piece I would add, just to kind of finalize this point, is the issue of sovereign debt, or in other words, public debt, is increasingly becoming a problem for the country. So, you know, we went through COVID, and COVID experience has really profoundly impacted the continent negatively. So right now, for example, 22 countries are either in debt crisis or debt distress, or are going into debt distress. And a lot of that has to do with, you know, what they had to use to respond to COVID, but also really a lot of African countries don't have good ways of revenue collection. So you have low tax revenues. The bigger one of all is high interest loans. And those loans used to be loans from mostly multilateral financial institutions like the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. But increasingly, you have China, both in terms of Chinese private lenders and others, Turkey have come into the picture. So it's becoming even more difficult to discuss debt relief, because now you have this combination of private creditors and multilateral institutions, both giving loans at very high interest rates. So this I see as a really problem now, but also, you know, as we look forward in the future, something that needs to be addressed very critically.
Yeah, it's a complicated, in addition to just the vast territory, the diversity, it's a complex web of challenges, you know, here is what I'm hearing from both of you. But it's not all challenges. You know, I think when we look at international engagement, Daniel, you were the one that I think raised this and our prep for this conversation today. When we look at international engagement, and especially with Africa, but also other parts of the world, you know, there can be a tendency to only hear about negative things if we hear about it at all. So where is there hope in this for you, Daniel, or Patricia, either one? Daniel, if you want to answer first.
Sure, I would open my response by addressing everyone on this call. You know, the Episcopal Church has a sign, I think every Episcopal Church has a sign outside, which says the Episcopal Church welcomes you. And I would say we are a people of hope. The work of global partnerships is your work, and you have a stake in this work. And I thank you. I've never met you. Many people in Burundi or Congo or Sudan, I've never met you. But they thank you for whenever you have stood with them, prayed with them, and remembered that they are our sisters and brothers in the faith. And so to answer your question, hope is really among the under 25 that Patricia made reference to, who are remarkably resilient despite the high levels of unemployment. Yes, they are vulnerable to being recruited by terrorists. They are vulnerable to suffer injustices like underemployment because they will take whatever will feed them for the day. But I can assure you that they are also full of faith. I remember a worship service that I attended in the diocese of Gitega in Burundi. And three quarters of the entire church was full with young and middle-aged people. And that's what you don't get to see when we hear about the violence in Congo, in Sudan, in Somalia, in Ethiopia. You don't hear the positive stories of resilience, faith, and hope. Hope is among the women who, for the most part, you know, are part of what they call the Mothers Union, who most of the time are the burden bearers of food insecurity and violence. They're on the front lines fighting every day. When the sun sets, they're thinking about how their families will be fed. When the sun rises, they rise up, and that is hope. For me, hope is found among the faith communities who have refused to give up on human suffering. And that is the message the Episcopal Church needs to hear. You cannot give up on those who are suffering unjustly in faraway places. Hope is found when an Episcopal parish in Maine buys a boat for a bishop in South Sudan so that they can cross over the river doing the work of evangelism. Hope is found in a small group in New Hampshire that have decided to come along, women and men in Angora, in a small parish, to support their Christian education work. So, I mean, I could go on and on and on, but we are a people of hope. And the question is, at your parish level, don't you ever discount that you don't have an opportunity to be an agent of hope because you have it.
Thank you for that, Daniel. And, you know, I think as well from the perspective of many of us, not assuming everyone listening in is a U.S. citizen, but we, many of us are, and myself included, you know, the U.S. has a particular influence around the world. And as, you know, U.S. citizens, as constituents of our elected representatives, I think we have an exaggerated responsibility and ability to speak out about foreign policy as well. But I'll use that to pitch that question back over to you, Patricia. Where do you see hope in this? Where are there some successes, some signs of mm-hmm. of good that's happening?
Yeah, and I really echo a lot of what Daniel shared. One thing I want to add on that question is looking at women's leadership in Africa is really inspiring and exemplary. And I don't hear this talked about often, but I think it's such a big success that needs to be flagged. Maybe it's because I also work on gender justice issues. But Africa, for example, is still a global leader in women's public leadership. Rwanda has 60% of parliamentarians. They lead the world. And then you have 5 African countries out of 20 nations who have the most representation of women in parliament. So, you know, stories you hear often is of vulnerability of women, which is there, right? A lot of, you know, there are a lot of things that are happening that are not great when it comes to women on the continent. But then you have, on the flip side, looking at leadership, political leadership, but also leadership as what Daniel shared in terms of leadership in the family. When it comes to food, food production, for example, the largest population of smallholder farmers on the continent are women, even though they don't always own the land. They don't take that as an obstacle. They fight for the right to, you know, own the land and own all these other things that they're entitled to, but also taking leadership in making sure that communities thrive. If you look at activism in different spaces, in different countries, a lot of the activists that you see, you know, deciding to really embark on something that will be beneficial to their communities or to their nation, a lot of times you see women on the front really pushing forward whatever agenda that they see is necessary for their communities. So I think we should celebrate that. I often do. And, you know, as you know, Alan, working in the policy space, it's very difficult because it seems like you're constantly addressing challenges and bad things, trying to fix things. So those stories and those kind of examples are often inspiring, and I think we should really lift them up for our churches.
Yeah, and I think, you know, Patricia, you know this work well. But there's a way that the relationships that, Daniel, you're a part of fostering and creating, the expertise, the perspectives that come from our Anglican siblings in Africa, you know, can play a part in policymaking in D.C. It wasn't for that purpose, but, you know, Daniel, you and I were just at the Episcopal Parish Network conference, and I was able to meet Bishops Dossie and Bishop Vicentia from the Diocese of Swaziland and the Diocese of Lesotho. Two other examples. There are women across the Anglican community in Africa, but those are two that are now, you know, in leadership positions in the church there. So it's reflected, you know, in our own institution, which is really wonderful. Shifting just a bit, so Pope Francis, the Archbishop of Canterbury, moderator for the Scottish Church as well, had just visited South Sudan and the DRC recently. So getting into an example here, perhaps, of some of these dynamics, some of the ways the church works there. Daniel and Patricia, but again, maybe starting with Daniel, what impact do you think a visit like that has, maybe that one in particular, and what it means for the future?
Let me start with the positive. I think a visit like that inspired hope and faith among the local populations in the Democratic Republic of Congo. That was a visible sign that the world has not forgotten their human suffering, which is easy to forget. Every other month, I do run a Congo network, and when we listen to the youth worker who is for the province, who is also running a peace center where they're receiving refugees arriving on a daily basis, they run out of space for women and children. And then when you look at that level of suffering and then watch the arrival of the Pope in Kinshasa, and close to a million people coming out for an open air mass in worship, in solidarity, I think it was a reminder of our interconnectedness, the interconnectedness of humanity. And the same is true in South Sudan. To the Pope's credit, he has gone out of his way to invite the two leaders who seem to be in disagreement, you know, in the Vatican. But at the end of the day, it's these leaders' responsibilities. It's not the primate, it's not the primate of England or the Pope. At the end of the day, it's these two leaders who are leading in Sudan who are going to be responsible for what happens. And unfortunately, unless the people are empowered enough to hold them accountable to what they have committed to, it becomes very, very, very difficult. And the gains made with such a visit, unfortunately, do not trickle down into the grassroots, where the difference has to be made where communities have to coexist and live peacefully with one another.
Yeah, Patricia, do you have anything to add about that visit?
Yeah, I think for me, one thing I took out of that visit was I was reminded that something like that will solidify, you know, the role that faith-based institutions and organizations already play on the continent. I mean, for example, in South Sudan, basically the South Sudan Council of Churches is the largest in, you know, non-government organization if you compare with other entities, and it's locally run. You know, the leaders are the leaders from the country. And, you know, as many of you know, even with foreign non-government organizations being present in a space like that, often the communities have some sort of reverence towards church leaders or towards some kind of faith institutions, and they listen to them more. So for me, it's hard to see how we from America, from Europe, can go in a country like South Sudan and really do whatever we want to do well without the engagement of the faith communities. And so that kind of visit really served to remind people that, you know, here you have the faith leaders who are doing really good work, especially on issues related to building peace in countries that are experiencing conflict like South Sudan, where they go to the remote areas, they know people in these communities, they're in their pews, you know, whatever they meet on Sundays for service, they know them by name. Sometimes, you know, they baptize their kids and things like that. So they have relationships that have been built over time. And we cannot underestimate those kind of roles that faith communities play. One of the things that I wanted just to share with you all, you know, when you look at countries that are experiencing conflict and maybe engaging in peace processes, often faith leaders would be consulted. I mean, that's what we actually usually push for too in our work in terms of advocacy, you know, making sure that they are consulted and often they are and giving their advice and recommendations on what they see will be helpful to their countries and their communities as far as solving those type of conflicts is concerned. So that kind of visit to me was just kind of a highlight of what's already happening. And my hope is that, you know, at the bare minimum, people are inspired because these are world leaders at a very high level taking their time to come visit. That in itself is encouraging. It's very hard to work in the context that a lot of our faith leaders work in, and the work can be very discouraging. So I take that as an inspiration to them, and hopefully they were encouraged by that.
And that makes sense. You know, and thinking about or staying with this, the topic of the role of faith communities, the role of faith leaders, knowing that the majority of our audience, you know, here and with the Office of Government Relations is based in the U.S., for either of you, from your respective perspectives, why should Episcopalians in the U.S. be engaged? And then, you know, more specifically, you know, what can they be doing?
Well, let me start with the theme of moral imagination. I think John Paul Redirect is a known peace scholar and practitioner, and he talks about moral imagination. But I'll take those words and you can look them up and see the definitions, you know, how to recognize turning points and possibilities and trying to find out what we have not yet found out, you know, venturing into the unknown subtle. And I would challenge ourselves as women and men of faith, as people of faith, by raising the question of the deficit of moral imagination in our engagements. Because I would make a huge assumption here that there is a deficit, that we tend to do that which is least uncomfortable, and we stay within the confines of what we know, and rarely risk to venture into the unknown. Now, that's a huge assumption I've just made, but there are some glimpses of hope in one of the programs that I'm just about to share with you. The Episcopal Volunteers in Mission is a program that is run by mission personnel in the Episcopal Church's Office of Global Partnerships, where we have, you know, not so young adults who volunteer their time with their skills to go to a place to share those gifts and talents. And I'm going to just lift up one, and her name is Miss Wendy. Wendy is from Utah, and she has been going to Tanzania for 8 years to work with clergy who are going through seminary to learn about ministries, working with people living with disabilities. As a mother, she raised 2 kids with disabilities, and that has been a huge gift to the church in Tanzania. And so I see that as one of the few examples on how we can fill the gap on the deficits of moral imagination. There's so many things that we can do and we can come up with that could fit that bill as people of faith, to build those relationships and to minimize human suffering and to help our siblings within the Anglican Communion and the ecumenical and interfaith circles.
Great, thanks for lifting that up, Daniel. Patricia, what are some things or a thing that people in the US can do?
Yeah, I want to stay with the theme that Daniel started for a moment in terms of volunteering, and maybe I will use the language of cultural exchange. In the secular spaces, they use that more. But one thing I've noticed is that often it's Americans or Episcopalians or Lutherans going over there, you know, to Africa, which is great. But I also would like to encourage us to receive Africans who are either coming here for mission work or for cultural exchange, because the relationship needs to be mutual. We can learn a lot from them. They can learn a lot from us here. And context and spaces do make a difference in terms of how someone experiences that culture. So I think it's important to have this mutuality in our relationships. In terms of advocacy, for me, you know, I cannot close this question without flagging that, because I think advocacy and civic engagement is really important. And I would like to encourage you to use your privilege as a citizen of one of the most powerful, richest country with a lot of influence in the world, to let your voice be heard on issues related to Africa as well. Sometimes you hear more people concerned about, you know, maybe domestic things that are happening here, and rightly so, and you should. But I think there's a lot of influence that you can have with your members of Congress or political candidates when it comes to Africa policy issues, Africa issues in general. So please use your voice in that way as well.
And can I add the power of technology? You don't have to have a lot of money to do what Patricia said. You could, you know, through technology, connect with so many places. And if you're searching and looking, contact our office. Let's be of help and see what we can find. So it could be a time of prayer that you do for 15 minutes in Zoom with somebody far out there. So there's so many ways, and we welcome your questions and how we might be of help along those lines.
Yeah, and I think it is a good time to turn to questions in the chat. I've posted in the chat a couple of invitations, but if folks do have questions for Daniel and Patricia, please do add them. We already have a couple, so we'll turn to those. And Daniel, you were leaning into this, and Patricia as well. You know, in both of our work in Washington and your work in global partnerships, you know, relationship is such a key word, and it's a key word in our faith, in carrying out our faith as well. And so things like fellowship, conversation, celebration, worship together, you know, builds a sense of our common humanity, I think, and helps to humanize one another, which to me are all positive ways to raise awareness, to feel closer to people, even if they may be physically far apart. But saying that to lead into a question from Valerie, Valerie says, I fear that so many Americans simply don't think of people around the world. What are strategies that have worked to raise awareness and compassion and enthusiasm for seeing African people as our siblings, full of hope and potential, and thus become willing to get involved in advocacy? So what are some of the kind of the motivators, the awareness building tactics that you've seen that are useful?
I would probably tap into the youth, because that's where we have the most energy. And I would go back to a parish, for example, a small parish like St. Anne's Parish in a small town outside Boston, the city of Lowell, Massachusetts. St. Anne's Episcopal Church, the young people of that parish can very quickly get connected with St. Polycarp Church in the slums of Mlango Kubwa in Nairobi, Kenya, or in the city of Bujumbura. And they're already doing that in other ways. So it's again a question of finding out how do we now take advantage and harness what is already there. We are not creating anything new. These are skills that they already have. And your siblings in Africa, they have the same gadgets. They have, you know, Wi-Fi, they have data. They may not have a lot of money, so most of the times the data is turned off. When I have to call, I have to send a text to say, can you turn on your data so that I can call you? And that's kind of how we make it. And we make it happen, and we communicate, and we get things going. So I would say that young people in a local parish, whether it's advocacy work, I don't think it will take much. They are highly interested and motivated to get connected. And I would say, again, if you're looking for ways to how do you practically do that, that's where we come in. We are only a phone call away, and we'll be happy to explore together.
One of the things that I learned after moving here, you know, I was born and raised in Tanzania, is the power of stories and how you tell a story. I think there's a lot of value in telling positive stories. Too often and for too long, stories that are told in this context of Africans are usually very negative. And you know, I remember when I got here the first time, and I was reminded of my experience where a lot of stories of America that you saw or heard were positive. And so you form this image of all positivity, and then you live in a context and you learn there's a lot of negativity too, but you know, you don't hear that as much, but it makes you curious. I'm saying that to get to a point where I want to say, please tell the positive stories. The media is doing enough to sell the negative stories. And I think, you know, positive stories usually inspire people and encourage people. You know, there's a reason why, you know, a lot of people in colleges want to study abroad in Europe, for example. Let's switch that and make sure that young people want to study abroad in African countries. And universities there have a lot of programs for folks from Europe and America and other countries. But that is coming from the power of telling positive stories. And so I just wanted to share that because I think it's really powerful.
Yeah, thanks for that reminder of what can motivate people, you know, and bring them together. I think that's exactly right. Another question in the post by Leon, imagine that you're faced with initiatives in Congress and in the executive branch to which you need to respond, even if those initiatives were not the church's priorities. What is before Congress now, if anything, or emerging from the executive branch that demands your attention, and how might that relate to the church's priorities?
Yeah, I'll just start my comments with saying, you know, this has been one of the slowest congressional sessions I've experienced so far. And so looking at what's coming out of Congress right now related to Africa, they haven't done a lot that I would like to see. We are focused on the appropriations process, which is important in terms of, you know, supporting African governments in their work around responding to humanitarian situations, responding to the ongoing food crisis in many countries. You know, right now we're experiencing inflation here, and the same thing is happening on the continent where commodity prices are very high. You know, the war in Ukraine has kind of exacerbated that right after we were experiencing the intensity of COVID. So life has become really challenging. So I don't want to take away from the appropriation work that we're doing right now. It's critical and a big part of our work. But we're hoping that there will be more bills around. One in particular for me will be on prevention of gender-based violence. Those bills haven't been introduced, but we're pushing for that, and definitely we'll make sure the EPPN network is aware of that. The executive branch has a strategy, Africa strategy, and they list a lot of things in that strategy. A lot of the focus is around, promoting democracy, national security issues. There's an ongoing competition, like Daniel said, among China, Russia, and the US right now in terms of influencing African countries, especially after the experience of the Ukraine vote at the United Nations, where a lot of African countries did not vote with the United States. They actually didn't want to take sides. And I think that was a wake-up call for the executive branch in general, realizing that they need to engage more with African countries because African governments and African leaders have kind of moved on and spread their wings in terms of how they engage with the world. So if you want to have an influence, you need to get in the ring. Anyway, so there isn't a lot coming out right now, but there's all these kind of geopolitical games that are happening right now that are also important in terms of policy work moving forward.
Sure, that makes sense. Well, I want to turn to just a couple of wrap-up questions as we conclude our time today. This sort of 30,000 foot view, maybe even higher than that, of U.S. engagement in Africa. But I think it's been, I know for me, a helpful conversation, and hopefully for others tuning in, it's helpful for you all as well to get your bearings and learn where you can plug in with this work. Daniel, I'll turn to you first, sort of a closing question. You've talked about what the Global Partnerships Office does and your role there. Maybe stepping back a bit from the details of Africa, but more fundamentally, our engagement. What's your perspective on ways to approach mission in the 21st century?
So, in the current setup, if you look at church growth, even with all the problems that we have described, the church is growing tremendously in Africa. Now, when we talk about mission work or missionary work, there's a lot of baggage that comes with that because of colonialism. And so when we talk about how do we engage today, part of it is decolonizing what our engagements are about, especially around theological education and leadership development. There is so much we can learn from the continent. So when you think about how do we or should we engage with Africa, think about the gifts you will receive, not so much you going to give, but the gifts that you're going to receive by your engagement and through your engagement. And I would say that the Young Adults Service Corps that Alan lifted up earlier is a great way and a great opportunity, because the young adults who engage with their counterparts on the continent, they are ready and eager to talk about the colonial legacies and how that needs to be put to the side as they create the what I call, you know, through moral imagination, the new priorities and new ways of engagement through relationship building. In other words, we are not going there to teach or to educate. You're going there to engage in a mutual relationship, fellowship of learning together, you know, growing together in the faith, and honestly, an exciting journey of mutual learning and collaboration. So if you know of a young adult out there who has, you know, a couple of months that they could spend, again, we are only a phone call away, an email away. We are happy to share about that. But there is a lot of excitement around decolonizing theological education and leadership development and how that is the gift to the Episcopal Church and the church in Europe, as well as the church in Africa.
Thanks for that. Taking that big question and giving a great sort of exclamation point answer for that. I think it's so important to keep that posturing in mind. So Patricia, as sort of a broad, you know, wrap-up question for you as well, thinking about your work in the context of government relations with the U.S. government, do you have anything more to add to the dynamics going on, things that people can do, what you were engaged in? I'll let you take that the direction you'd like.
Yeah, thank you. That's very dangerous. I'm joking. one thing I just want to leave people with is along the lines of what Daniel mentioned, is this mutual partnership also when you're doing or supporting programs or projects. I don't think it's feasible in the 21st century to go in and say, I want to do this project for you. We need to posture differently and say, you know, ask them, what do you need me to do? What do you want from me? And so in position of projects, programs, or sometimes in even cultural imposition is very much rejected right now on the continent. And I think there's a certain experience that people have had that Daniel highlighted that have just made people fed up. So it's really important to consult and to be sure that whatever you're engaged in, whatever you're trying to support is really coming from the folks you're engaging with on the continent and not from you as an individual or from your church and parish, because that's what you want to do. Let's do what they want us to do. And that's what we thrive to do when it comes to advocacy. When we're doing advocacy on different things, we really try our best to make sure that we get feedback or consult with our Anglican communion partners on the continent to make sure that it's relevant and we are sending a message that they want us to send. And when we have opportunities for them to be in Washington or in New York, for example, making sure that they also, to give them the space also to visit and share that message with policymakers in those spaces as well. And that's really important. And I think that's what, is distinctive in terms of organizations or institutions that have these kind of relationships versus a think tank that is mainly focusing on doing research without engaging with people on the ground. So I will leave at that, Alan. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you, Patricia. And thank you, Daniel. I see, Patricia, your background is U.S. Capitol Building, and Daniel, yours is a map of Africa. I'm here in a home office. And so just want to note that to remind everyone tuning in that wherever you are, you can be a part of this work. You can be a part of this relationship building. So I hope that the resources that we've shared are helpful, that this conversation is inspiring. And as Daniel mentioned, and I'll emphasize, our offices are here as resources for you. So please do reach out to the Global Partnerships Office, to the Office of Government Relations, for any needs that you have as we continue this relationship building work together. So thank you all for tuning in. Thank you, Susie, from the Office of Government Relations, who's done tech support. She also covers our environmental portfolio. And thank you to Natalie for your interpretation services today as well. I appreciate you all tuning in and look forward to engaging with you next time. Take care.
The Office of Government Relations aims to represent the policy priorities of the Episcopal Church to the U.S. government in Washington, D.C., and to influence policy and legislation on critical issues, all while highlighting voices and experiences of Episcopalians and Anglicans globally. The office facilitates the Episcopal Public Policy Network, a grassroots network of Episcopalians engaged in the ministry of public policy advocacy. Take action and learn more by following the links in the description. The Episcopals podcast is produced by the staff of the Office of Government Relations, with support from our podcast engineer, Ellie Singer, and project manager, Chris Sikkema. Thanks for listening, and join us next time on Episcopals.
You're invited to join thousands of Episcopalians, neighbors, and friends this summer at the Love Always Revival at the KFC Yum Center in Louisville, Kentucky. On Saturday, June 22nd, get immersed in inspiring worship and community, deepen your love for God, kick off the 81st General Convention, and extend a warm welcome to folks discovering the Episcopal Church. The revival is free to attend, so bring your friends. If you're from a neighboring diocese, check in with your diocesan revival champion to find out about group travel options. You can find more information along with registration at iam.ec/lovealways.